after midnight. Wednesday, partly sunny with a high of 28 and a wind out of the northwest from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Wednesday night through Thursday night, mostly cloudy with lows in the mid-teens and a high Thursday in the upper 20s. And the outlook for Friday, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 30s and a low Friday night in the low 20s. At noon Central Time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana ranged from the mid-20s to the upper 30s. Most locations were cloudy. There were some areas of fog at O'Hare Airport. In Chicago, 26 degrees at the top of the hour. It was 24 at Bloomington Normal, 32 at Danville. Mattoon reported 30 degrees, Carbondale 39. South Bend reported some snow flurries and 25 degrees, Lafayette 33, Terre Haute 33, and Indianapolis 30. Willard Airport reported cloudy skies with some fog, 29 degrees at the top of the hour, the dew point 26. The relative humidity at the top of the hour was 89%, the wind out of the southwest at 12, giving us a wind chill index of 19, the barometric pressure 30.04 and falling. And on the campus of the University of Illinois at 12:38 Central Time, cloudy skies, although we have a little bit of some dim sunshine at the moment, 29 degrees. New York is one of the world's great theater cities, but it's not every season that several of the world's greatest theater companies visit and bring some of the greatest classical plays to share. That could be one reason sales at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, or BAM, have been unusually brisk, Jeff London reports.
Joe Melillo, the Brooklyn Academy of Music's executive producer, says theatergoers are hungry for a diet of Ibsen, Gogol, and Shakespeare. Ticket sales for BAM's classical theater season have been brisk.
They're flying. They have like little wings. The tickets are flying out of the box office.
And even if these plays are over 100 or 400 years old, the artists who are presenting them say they resonate for contemporary audiences. Take John Gabriel Borkman, Henrik Ibsen's 1896 drama, which is currently playing at BAM. The title character, a banker, has been imprisoned for illegally investing his client's money. Think Bernie Madoff. Actress Fiona Shaw plays Borkman's wife.
You see the byproduct of these legal battles that the families fall apart because financial difficulties or financial shame produces a terrible fallout in families.
On an even more universal level, Ibsen's three characters are imprisoned by their own delusions and bitterness, says Alan Rickman, who plays Borkman, and Lindsay Duncan, who plays the woman he abandoned.
They're locked in the past, aren't they? And they've all got different views of the past. And frankly, that's something I recognize from life and families.
They're just very exaggerated versions of people we all know.
We all know them. We've all grown up with these people.
In Ibsen's third act, the three characters, who have not seen each other for years, confront one another.
What is this? What does he want down here with me?
He wants to reach some agreement with you, Gunhild.
He never wanted to before.
Tonight, he does.
The last time we faced each other, it was in court. I was summoned to testify.
Tonight, I want to testify.
Delusional characters are at the heart of BAM's next presentation as well. It's an adaptation of Nikolai Gogol's short story, The Diary of a Madman, starring Academy and Tony Award winner Jeffrey Rush. Rush says even though Gogol wrote it about a mid-level bureaucrat in 1835 Russia, it feels like modern absurdist writing.
Gogol walks this very knife-edge, fine line between a very sharp observation of someone's descent into madness and at the same time playing fairly deliciously with their own sense of delusion.
And Rush says as he was discovering his character,
I kept saying this is a Daffy Duck moment where, you know, his beak has suddenly been smashed around at the back of his face. And we took a lot of inspiration from Chuck Jones because he made that great quote at one point where he said, Bugs Bunny is the person we would probably all like to be. Daffy Duck is the person we probably really are. So it's a comment on that level of self-delusion of what our aspirations might be and how short they might fall.
Why don't you take a good look in the mirror? He's got a head like one of those bottles you see in chemists. What does he know of love? Oh, I know where this comes from. Beware, my lord, of jealousy. Pushkin. Someone. It's the green-eyed something or other. Oh, yes, no doubt you've noticed the 1,001 little preferences and benevolences he has bestowed on me. Not a ruble to my name, is it? Jesus had not a shirt, and you can go to hell.
If Geoffrey Rush's character descends into madness, the same is true of Shakespeare's King Lear, which Derek Jacobi is bringing over from England. Michael Grandage has directed the production and says Jacobi told him...
Classical actors certainly go through hoops, and the first of them is the Hamlet hoop, and the last one usually is the Lear hoop. And if you pass, he says, the Hamlet test early on, then people say that you're allowed to play your Lear when you get to the right age.
And at age 72, Jacobi has reached the right age. Grandage says while the play has large political dimensions, Shakespeare has tapped into something more primal.
The centre of the play is a great domestic drama, and he clearly was a man who was writing with a huge degree of knowledge about the nature of an ageing parent.
Monster ingratitude!
If thou wert my full nuncle, I'd have thee beaten for being old before thy time.
How's that?
Thou shouldst not have been old till thou'dst been wise.
Oh, let me not be mad. Not mad. Sweet heaven, keep me in temper. I would not be mad.
We have different words for it now. Of course, in Shakespeare's time, it was called madness, and it's called madness throughout the play. But for madness now, we have dementia, we have a whole load of actual labels, and labels where a modern audience, through the sad misfortune of their own families and their own ageing parents or their own ageing relations, have access to people who start to lose their mind in some way.
Where have I been? Where am I? Fair daylight? I am mightily abused. I know not what to say. I will not swear these are my hands. I am a very foolish, fond old man, and to deal plainly, I fear I'm not in my perfect mind. Methinks I should know you, and know this man, yet I am doubtful. For I am mainly ignorant what place this is, and all the skill I have remembers not these garments, nor I know not where I did lodge last night. Do not laugh at me, for as I am a man, I think this lady to be my child.
Not all of BAM's classical theater season deals with madness and delusion. A production of Shakespeare's The Comedy of Errors is coming as well. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
The New York Times last week noted the case of a curious forger. A man named Mark Landis has been going around the country donating works to museums that he claims are by more famous artists, not in exchange for money, but for what the Times reported was a kind of satisfaction at seeing his works accepted as authentic. One of the many questions this raises is, if he didn't sell these works, is this a crime? Here's commentator Travis McDade.
American law does not have a rich history punishing people for art forgery, though, like a lot of art crime, this has less to do with lack of will than opportunity. For a variety of reasons, there simply aren't a lot of forgers caught in the United States. This is what makes the case of Mark Landis all the more interesting. According to the art newspaper in New York Times, he has been traveling the country, giving museums paintings he says are the work of more famous artists. So far, no legal action has been taken against him, and there is some doubt if any can be. For one thing, he apparently hasn't sold any of the pieces to museums. And for another, his motivation to simply see his work hanging on walls has had a disarming effect. But, as it happens, the impetus for forgery isn't always money. It certainly wasn't for the most infamous American forger of the last half century, Mark Hoffman. His primary motivation for inventing documents supposedly created by founders of the Mormon Church was to embarrass the elders and hierarchy. It was only later that he became addicted to the considerable money and prestige that accrued to him when he continued to, quote, find these documents. Prestige, commingled with revenge, was also the stated motivation of Hans von Meegeren, the 20th century's most notorious forger. When the Northern European art world rejected his own work, von Meegeren set about forging works by Johann Vermeer. Regardless of these men's motivations, the harm was the same. Still, the lack of money in the Landis case does complicate things. At the federal level, there is a fine statute for prosecuting art theft, but not one specifically for forgery. So these are prosecuted, when they're prosecuted, under fraud statutes, mail fraud, wire fraud, conspiracy to defraud. And these usually do the trick. Unfortunately, $0 is less than $5,000, the amount federal prosecutors require for non-governmental fraud. Several states, on the other hand, have laws specifically concerning art forgery, regardless of the money involved. Ohio's law is fairly typical. It prohibits what it calls criminal simulation. It says that no person shall make or alter any object so that it appears to have value because of antiquity, rarity, curiosity, source, or authorship. But even though money isn't a stated element, unless there is more than $500 involved, the crime is only a misdemeanor. Anyway, a recent review of case law suggests that the heart of America is not a hotbed of easily spotted art forgery. Crimes prosecuted under this Buckeye statute include knockoff DVDs, CDs, purses, baby formula, and $100 bills, but no Monets, Manets, or Picassos. Of course, the criminal realm isn't the only one that protects our legal interests. Civil courts are a popular place for museums to go when they discover what they thought was a Bernini from Naples was really a Joe from Paramus, New Jersey. In the civil system, too, fraud is a heavy hitter, and museums who feel they were duped by Landis might go this route. But again, money is the problem. The law, like Renaissance artists, likes a nice round figure, and while even donations require some expenditure on the part of a museum, it is unlikely to be enough to make a civil case worth the effort. Unless one of these art museums built a wing to accommodate one of Landis's pieces, there's not a lot they can hope to gain at trial. But forgery does real harm, not only to the integrity of individual collections, but also the art world in general, not to mention the legacy of the victim artist. That's a fact that needs to be considered by an aggrieved museum or creative prosecutor. While going to court might not make sense on an individual level, it might be just what the art world needs. I'm Travis McDade.
Travis McDade is a professor of law at the University of Illinois. You can hear Legal Issues in the News every Monday on Morning Edition or hear it online at will.illinois.edu.
Join us next time on Illinois Pioneers as we examine the history of Parkland College with two of its earliest employees. We'll revisit the days 45 years ago when 1,300 members of the first class and their instructors spread out in temporary quarters throughout Champaign, how the permanent campus site was chosen, and how Parkland quickly became an important part of the fabric of East Central.